Welcome to the Accredited Canadians Toolkit. This is the episode for Saturday, January 20th, 2024, and I'm your host, Sam Perrin. Horace Mann said, "Until you've done something for humanity, you should be ashamed to die." I've had the opportunity to reflect on the human condition recently. With aging family members in and out of hospital and beginning to experience more frequent health problems, and a recent seminar that had many exercises to remind me of my own mortality, it's become a renewed topic of interest for me, and I've spent some time each day thinking about it of late. Many thoughtful people have commented on mortality, but a very interesting and fresh perspective for me is that of Christopher Hitchens. He wrote a series of columns in Vanity Fair, and while he was in the process of dying from stage 4 esophageal cancer. His editor compiled all of his articles together into a book, so I'll review that book and add my comments on mortality at the end. So feel free to skip this episode if this topic is not yet of interest to you. Chapter 1 of the book is Christopher Hitchens' description of the abrupt change of the journey, quote, "from the country of the well across the stark frontier that marks off the land of malady," end quote. Chapter 2 and 3 were focused on how the belief system of those who are afflicted with illness and those around them collide, with some grumbling about the legal limits that have been put on cancer treatment research based on what he describes as arbitrary moral grounds. And the example given is a lawsuit which is surrounding the use of soon-to-be-discarded human embryos that are left over after IVF treatments. Chapter 4 was a discussion on the need for an etiquette handbook for those residents of the two towns, the two areas he calls Tumor Town and its neighbors in the land of the well. The response to the well-meaning question that people ask you all the time when you're sick, "How are you?" The response to that is difficult to decide how to answer. His responses that he describes included, "It's a bit early to tell," or "I seem to have cancer today," or "The thing about stage 4 cancer is there is no stage 5. He was, in the end, mindful of his audience and wishing that they would repay him the favor, because this one excerpt of the book stuck out to me. He said, quote, "Nobody wants to be told about the countless minor horrors and humiliations that become the facts of life when your body turns from being a friend to being a foe." He also wrote that hearing stories of people beating a different disease was of no interest to him. In Chapter 5, Christopher offers valuable advice for aspiring writers, including to write like you talk and to intentionally be good at talking. And he worried that the loss of his ability to communicate and by the loss of his voice and the loss of his hands due to neuropathy from the chemotherapy would cut off his ability to communicate. And that was the reason for living for him. So the fact that we're able to read about those fears means that they did not come to pass. So I'm glad for him that almost to the very end of his life, he was able to engage in what he loved, in writing and the freedom of speech. In Chapter 6, we witness Christopher's sufferings. He describes them makes various examples where he proves as best he can his sentiment and feeling that the saying, "What doesn't kill us will make us stronger," is false a lot of the time. So this is a quite sad part of the book to read, and I'm sure it was much more sad to actually live through it. In Chapter 7, Christopher recounts his experience at waterboarding, trying that out to demonstrate that it is indeed a torture method. And he parallels the feeling that he felt suffocating and drowning while he was engaging in waterboarding. He parallels that involuntary torture. He parallels his current involuntary torture because of his illness, to that voluntary torture that he undertook for the sake of his opinion column. Chapter 8 and the afterword of the book were actually really well done by the editor. Chapter 8 is actually just fragments of various unfinished chapters, paragraphs, and ideas. And it gives an interesting insight into Christopher's writing process. The afterword is where the voice changes, because now it is Hitchens' wife, Carol Blue, who's speaking about her feelings now that Christopher's died. And she shares that Christopher's last writings were in the hospital bed using the meal tray as a desk. And she's reflecting how thankful she is that she can hear Christopher's voice anytime she wants in the scrawled notes that are inside the covers of the books of his library and scattered on notes across their apartment. So some of Christopher's observations that I found insightful in reading about his process of dying is that those in the land of the ill would prefer that you listen to them rather than speak and dole out advice. He was resigned to his fate and was quick to accept the opinions of those at the hospital he was at in Houston, Texas. And he wrote that even if he had a private jet, he wouldn't have had time to visit every hospital or place that proposed a cure. So he stopped his search for a cure somewhat prematurely, in my opinion. But he deliberately stated that instead of asking, why me, he instead asked, why not me? He owned the fact that drinking heavily and smoking 2 packs a day for 40 years had made this way that he's ending his life far more probable. So some part of me is sad that he accepted his fate so quickly and didn't have more fight in him, because it would have been good to watch his thought evolve as current events and as he aged, and just to see how his commentary would have changed. But the fact is, every man has to decide for himself how he's going to live and for how long in circumstances like this. So I picked up on his most important words in the book, and it was, my chief consolation in this year of living dyingly has been the presence of friends. So I've decided, after reflecting on this, that I'm going to try and be the best listener I can be for my friends and family who find themselves in this type of a situation. And then if I must speak, I'll try and insert joy into the mood. But I'll also be vulnerable and be okay to be present and share some tears too, when that's what's required. It's very difficult to avoid feeling permanently melancholy and becoming depressed, or speaking too plainly or harshly about the realities of death when your loved one is gravely ill. And that was my mood when I was initially going to release this podcast, and I'm glad I waited, because it's allowed me some time to process and to turn my mind to a more joyful attitude. It's important to actively cultivate hope, because hope for the future gives you and your audience energy for today. Other thoughts I've had is that if one focuses on the fact that some people claim science states the facts are that the whole universe, the whole world and the whole universe is right now in a state of decay, and everything is burning just at different rates. But I've witnessed, in being a parent, I've had the firsthand privilege of observing the beginning of the cycle of life. And from that, from the newness of an infant to the gradual growth into a young adult, spending time with happy children actually flies in the face of this very despondent view of life. So some science argues that life stands in stubborn defiance of entropy. So there, life isn't hopeless if you really examine it. So what is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything? Well, according to a book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, the answer is 42. And if that answer seems absurd, it's because the question is also absurd. There's a song by Five for Fighting called The Riddle, and they sing that the reason for the world It's You and I. That's a great song. I suggest listening to it. It's very poetic. Anyway, I found the best way to deal with the absurdity of our mortality is with a steady dose of humor. The culture of Tesla injects this humor into everyday user experiences, and I suspect it's the same for the people who are working on the products. And the result is some incredibly innovative technology with an end product that can really delight its users. There's many Easter eggs, like the cowbell SNL skit reference that comes on when you engage cruise control, or one of the most recent software updates allows you to change the tone that the vehicle emits when the doors are locked. So you can choose from whatever's provider, upload your own, but I was looking through the various options and I found one that sounds a lot like a duck quack. So for some reason, I found that quack to be absolutely hilarious. So now whenever my car locks itself when I walk away, there's a very loud, audible quack. And if there's people around, it turns some heads. And even when I'm grumpy from a commute, when I leave the car and that quack sound goes on, it breaks me out of my negative mindset and reminds me to find the joy. So that injects humor into my day. And I recall seeing a study on happiness at the different stages of life, and that midlife, kind of where I'm starting to find myself, can be one of the most miserable stages because of the pressure of having young children while at the same time having to care for elderly parents. And the midlife crisis is a common trope that speaks on this, but maybe you've heard of the other way of describing it as the sandwich generation. Interestingly, I've also read recently that people under 25 generally feel older than their age, and people older than 25 usually feel younger despite obvious changes happening in their bodies. And I also reflect that in my former career I had an experience where I was arresting an inebriated young woman, and she was crying and yelling on repeat, "I'm only 27 years old, I'm only 27 years old." You know, basically stating she wasn't old enough to be, to have the responsibilities of being a mother, and that she just wanted to party and she'd gotten herself into some trouble, which is how I'd gotten involved in the situation. But, you know, at the time I was very perplexed about that experience because this was a person who was 5 years my senior, and I had the responsibilities of looking after almost an entire town by myself, the safety of a town by myself. And I was a lot younger than this person who's saying, "I'm only 27 years old." So I guess we all mature at different rates, but the occasional feeling of not being old enough to deal with the responsibilities that life and circumstance can thrust upon you, that's a universal feeling. So I wonder if time does indeed fly by, or if it's just a symptom that our growth in various stages of adulthood has become stunted because new experiences seem to really make time slow down. So I think of, as I reflect on all this, I thought of a scene in a movie that called The Fiddler on the Roof. And the father in that movie dreams about becoming a rich man, and he sings the song, and if you heard it, it's quite a famous song, you might recognize it. He sings about the benefits of being rich, which in his limited capacity or his limited imagination as a Russian peasant Jew, it includes having a great many turkeys and ducks, having important men in town seek his advice, whether he knew what he was talking about or not, and having enough money so his wife would have plenty of servants to yell at instead of at him. So the song is quite funny, but it's also insightful because in the end, he says that the sweetest thing of all would be to be able to sit for hours and discuss the holy books with learned men. So I think the sentiment reflected in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where human needs begin with physical security and they end with self-actualization, it fits nicely in with this song from Fiddler on the Roof, because we're very fortunate in the Western world that many of us have ample time to engage in self-actualization and reflection and to sit around and discuss books with learned men. So when I reflect on the very fact that I have the time to think so much about my own mortality and everything that I've spoken about here so far, it fills me with real gratitude that I have that luxury of time to be able to do that. And gratitude indeed seems to be an antidote for depression and melancholy. So while I enjoy reading Christopher Hitchens and hearing his recorded speeches, I find it a shame that he was such a slave to his vices. And I imagine what more he could have done if he didn't party so hard, both by living longer and by increased productivity through spending less time inebriated. Perhaps if his talent was paired with a more focused work ethic, instead of simply commenting on the great happenings and people in the world, he could have actually more actively been one of them. Although maybe that this statement and my view of his life is unfair, because I have no doubt that his words have influenced a great many decision makers, so his impact might have a much farther reach than I imagine, and maybe the farthest reach of all, because the fact is he died over a decade ago and he's still studied and spoken about. So Christopher Hitchens is going to live into perpetuity due to his life's written and spoken words, and I take comfort in knowing that I can as well, at least for anyone who cares to listen or read my body of work. Maybe one day people that I care about are going to be able to reap the benefits of my work long after I'm gone by reading or listening to these musings, or by, you know, otherwise enjoying the fruits of my labor. And in a similar way, I hope that my ramblings here today have somehow helped you wrestle with mortality too. So as you think about this episode of The ACT Show, I don't only wish you a great day, but I invite you to act to make it so, and you'll be surprised at your results. See you next time.